Welcome to the Big 60s Sort Out, brought to you by the Big Beatles Sort Out. We've spent three series sorting the Beatles, and now we're turning our attention to the competition, the context, the bigger picture. Who are they up against? What music influenced them? And will we hear the shockwaves of the Beatles' epic success as we sort all the UK number ones from the 1960s by ranking them for music, lyrics and production? Thanks for joining us as we try and sort out the 60s. Welcome to Series 4, Episode 15. I'm Gary Abbott, author, musician, podcaster, and please welcome my popular music history expert brother, Paul.
Hello, everyone. I hope everyone is okay and not troubled by too many ghosts of Elvis.
Right. Elvis ghosts.
Yeah, that's only because our most recent episode came out and a couple of people have mentioned that they liked Ghost Elvis.
Oh,
I forgot. I don't even remember doing Ghost Elvis.
No. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. Did you also see that we are, Elvis is our 15th cousin?
Well, yeah, is he? Really?
Well. I mean,
he's probably everyone's 15th cousin.
Probably, but yeah, because mum's actually whacked our family history research into one of these things that blocks it all out and connects them up. We've got, you know, we are apparently his 15th cousin.
Which means essentially not related.
Yeah. But I like to think that's why we're so good at doing Elvis impressions.
Yeah, well, maybe. Anyway, yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Please keep in touch with us on Twitter and Instagram at @big_sort or email us at bigbeatlessortout@gmail.com. And please also like and subscribe and give our show a review if you would be so kind.
And we did get a review, I noticed, on Chartable from someone whose name is I Am the Ghost of Troubled Joe.
Okay.
So...
Thank you, I Am the Ghost of Troubled Joe.
Joe Meek, presumably, commenting on
this. Oh, gosh, yeah.
We did Telstar.
Well, was it a good review?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Well, thank you, whoever that was. And please consider dropping by our Bandcamp things at the bottom. I'm, as of recording, still awaiting kind of release dates for my album. It will be on the description if it were to happen before this comes out. Yeah, Paul, have we got any shout-outs, news, things and what's it?
I've got a shout-out for a book that I'd like to mention. Mm. So I'm very big on supporting it and mentioning my friends who do stuff independently. And one of those people is a chap called Adam Paxman. Mm-hmm. Adam Paxman, who I used to work with, is a very good friend. He's a very good artist and he's got a very strange and funny brain in the best way, in a sort of Dadaist, anti-art way. And he, years ago, he used to do a character called Burning Zebra, who was a little stuffed zebra doll, and he was the sort of protagonist of his stories. And they were very, very odd stories. But time goes by, and you start a little family, and you want to write books for kids. So now we have released, entirely the wrong time of year, Burning Zebra, Revenge of the Christmas Vampire. And this is available through Amazon as an ebook or a hardback. And I zipped straight out and bought it because it is great. I've always loved the stuff he does. So let me read you the précis here. So, welcome readers, old and young. Now wrap up warm and brace yourselves for adventure. Burning Zebra and his friends face a cold winter and the return of a familiar Yuletide monster in Revenge of the Christmas Vampire. Originally released on Instagram as a serialised daily advent calendar in 2017. That's quite a while ago, isn't it now? Hmm. It's collected here in book format for the very first time. And what I love about it is that not only is it a great story with great illustrations and a great sense of the absurd, it also features a lot of my friends and people I know in various strange anthropomorphic animal format.
Oh, are you in there?
I'm in there, and Lorraine is in there as well, yes.
Ooh,
so buy the book and see if you can guess who who I am.
Okay.
That's what I would say. So this is Burning Zebra. This is Burning Zebra, Revenge of the Christmas Vampire by Adam Paxman. You can find it on Amazon.
Very good.
Support independent authors and artists.
Yes, indeed. I look forward to that. I'll have a look at that. I'll try and spot you in there. yeah, so we're getting to a crunch time. I think
crunch,
we might
crunch.
Be in a crunch time. So... we're going to get a strange kind of overlap here.
Yes.
When I say to you, what were the Beatles up to at this time? Because we're well, let's remind ourselves where we're at. We are now in March to kind of June 1963 period.
We are for this episode, yeah.
So I suppose skirting around any actual songs we might end up talking about, what were the Beatles up to at this time, Paul?
Well, they were having a grand old time being pop stars, finally.
Hey.
Albeit just British ones at this point. But of course, the story, as we have been saying, is one of touring, touring, touring. But the tours that they're on are becoming sort of more high profile. I mean, Helen Shapiro's a high profile person to tour with anyway. And we left it just after they'd finished the Helen Shapiro tour last time.
Mm.
But literally, I think it's 5 days later, they start out on their next tour with some American artists this time.
Right.
So this is the Chris Montez and Tommy Rowe tour. Chris Montez, most famous for doing Let's Dance. So that's like a UK number two. Everyone knows Let's Dance, a very well-known song.
What does it go like?
Let's dance, da 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 da.
Let's dance, da da da. Oh, it's Stonk.
It's not the Stonk. The Stonk's a wholly original song for Comic Relief by Hale and Pace.
Okay.
So don't get confused, but don't put me on the spot for Let's Dance.
Okay.
My mind went totally blank then, even though I know it perfectly well. Yeah, Chris Montez is most famous for Let's Dance. He had a number two hit with that, and then he had a sort of number 10 in the UK with the follow-up, which is Some Kind of Fun. Tommy Rowe had a number three hit in the UK with Sheila. His next one was number 37. But we will be seeing Tommy Rowe again.
Okay.
In this series, but not for another 6 years.
Oh, okay. Off your pop, Tommy.
Yeah. But for the time being, Tommy and Chris are headlining this tour with the Beatles and a bunch of other people. This is a spring tour. Starts on the 9th of March 1963 and takes them through to the end of March. And this is one of the ones where you've got two halves of the show, made up a load of acts, and one of the big acts would close the first half and one would close the second half. So Montez and Rowe would swap who was closing each half until it became obvious that everyone wanted the Beatles to be, you know, in a really prime spot. So they end up closing the first half, rather.
Mm.
This is one of the ones where some people say that the Beatles ended up topping the bill.
Right.
On this one, they didn't. They closed the first half. But it's still loads of work, even if they're only playing like six songs per show.
Mm.
Which is a heck of a come down from Hamburg, isn't it?
Yes.
At this point, because they're not having to learn new material to fill out time. Now it's just promoting their stuff. So they're doing Love Me Do, Misery, A Taste of Honey, Do You Want to Know a Secret, Please Please Me, and I Saw Her Standing There as their typical set list.
Yeah.
But for each show, they're doing two houses generally, like an early or late afternoon, early evening type thing. All sorts of places. But they do six shows, without John, because he gets a cold and isn't well enough to perform.
Right. I suppose, they can battle on as a three-piece, can't they?
Oddly, possibly, I mean, if George dropped out, they could have done it, but possibly not. I don't know.
Mm.
It's a bit of a funny one, really. John, the most expendable member.
Yeah, because Paul, it's hard to imagine.
You need the bass, you need the drums, you need a guitar, and you need a guitar that can probably do some of the twiddly bits. So.
And you need a singer who can sing everything. And that's, of all of them, it's going to be Paul, isn't it? So.
Yeah, and George was pretty good at just stepping into harmonies for whatever, you know. So, yeah, they do several shows as a three-piece. So it must have been mad if the only time you saw the Beatles in your life was, say, the 14th of March 1963 in Wolverhampton. And it's like, oh, yeah, brilliant three-piece band we saw.
Is there any footage or recordings of a three-piece Beatles?
I don't think there is, no.
Hmm.
No. But if we go down during that course of that little run, they have they're in Doncaster on the 22nd of March 1963, which is when the Please Please Me album comes out.
Right.
So they're now a band with an album as well, not just the singles that they've got. And they have a show back in Liverpool where obviously they're very well received. Then they go straight into, essentially after that tour, into their own spring tour, including the show at Stowe School, the one that was recovered on that recording. Mm. Was it last year, the year before? 2 years ago.
It was last year, wasn't it? The Stowe School stuff.
Was it? Yeah. All right, maybe it was. I don't know. Time doesn't mean anything. We have a date, the 11th of April 1963. We will come back to, but they were in Middleton at the Cooperative Hall that night. They have, at this point, I've got the words "The Cavern Club" written down once, as opposed to like ponging back to it like all the time before. Yeah. And they're going through, and then we have a weird moment where they all actually have a holiday.
Oh.
Between, so...
Together or separately?
Well, 28th of April to the 9th of May is basically this block of time for their holiday.
Mm.
Paul, George and Ringo go to Tenerife via Barcelona. John goes to Barcelona with Brian.
Right.
Not long after the birth of his son. You know, it's that very famous John goes off with Brian thing. That's been sort of covered in the biopic, The Hours and Times, which is, well, it's not really a biopic. It's a sort of, you know, version of what might have happened there. But yeah, very, sort of, it's only strange in the sense that he's a new father. It's his time off, but he's gone, decided in some way to sort of go off with Brian alone to Spain.
Yeah,
it shouldn't be odd, but it is odd because of the dynamic of the rest of them going off together.
Yeah,
and him sort of, as Paul says, I think it's like it's sort of John stamping his position in the group a bit further by being the one.
Do you think he was kind of like the big boys are going off on their holiday, and you're going on like I'm. He was counting himself amongst the administration of the group.
Well, I don't think so. I think he was just sort of saying, you know, if Brian's the boss and he's looking after us, I'm going to sort of make sure that me as the band boss goes with him.
That's what I mean. Yeah, he's kind of saying he's kind of.
But that's just one way of interpreting it. You know, there's comments about John about it from John and things like that. We're not going to get into all that now. But yeah, it's just weird that the point where they could split up, John doesn't go home and spend time with his young family. He goes off with Brian, and the other three go off together.
Mm.
And yeah, so they do come back, start up the touring again, and then they have the Roy Orbison tour.
Right.
Which is features a bunch of different people, including Gerry and the Pacemakers.
Mm.
And they do a whole bunch of dates. And as we know, this is the one where Roy Orbison basically, the screams for the Beatles are so much, it's like they've got to close the show.
Yeah.
You know, and Roy, being great, is like, do you know what? Fine, I'm getting paid three times as much as you. You can close the show. It's okay.
Yeah, not precious.
No. But yeah, their set list here apparently is Some Other Guy, Do You Want to Know a Secret? Then they do Love Me Do or A Taste of Honey.
Mm.
From Me to You, Please Please Me, I Saw Her Standing There, and closed with either Twist of Shout or Long Tall Sally.
Hmm.
So, that you know, these are very compact shows. You think of the length of those songs and playing them live. And yeah, so that's basically how they close out the next bit of the year there, during which time they play at Hanley in Stoke-on-Trent again.
Again. Oh, actually, we left them there last week.
Yeah, at the Gaumont.
Yeah.
Which is the Regent Theatre.
That's the Regent.
That's the Regent in Hanley now, Stoke-on-Trent fans. Back at the Empire again in Liverpool. And on one of the dates, 28th of May 1963, EMI extends their contract for a year because, you know, after the fraughtness of actually getting them signed, they are now proving to be a massive success.
Yeah.
And they get, their royalty rate goes up from not very much to still not very much.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this is the start of the whole thing. They're solidified as EMI recording artists now, and they're just, at this point, working.
Working that Beatle thang. Okay. So, whilst they were working, and being massive stars, who were they up against? I'm just back in the intro.
Yes.
You know. Who were they rubbing shoulders with at this point? So we find out on the way to their big breakthrough. Well, first up, it might not be a surprise, we have Cliff Richard and the Shadows, Summer Holiday.
We're all going on a summer holiday. No more working for a week or two. Fun and laughter on a summer holiday. No more worries for me or you for a week or two. We're going where the sun shines brightly. We're going where the sea is blue. We've seen it.
Summer holiday, Paul.
That would be lovely, but it's only Easter, Gary. It's Easter holiday.
I'm just thinking ahead.
Yeah. And while I was saying that, what I did was I looked at my watch like I was actually checking the date for the purposes
podcast
of that.
Podcast gold.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, I looked at the date on my computer screen. But yeah.
Yeah. Summer holiday, Cliff Richard in the Shadows. I'd say this is one of Cliff's most well-known, if not maybe his absolute best-known song.
Absolutely most well-known, yeah. This and between this and Living Doll and the Young Ones, I'd say.
Yeah, they're the triumvirate. Mm. This gets to number one on the 14th of March 1963, spends 3 weeks at number one, although it does dip down and re-enter.
Right.
And I suspect we'll find out what knocked it off for 1 week in a second.
Oh.
It is written by Bruce Welch and Brian Bennett from The Shadows, so that's not bad. Although I believe they don't really hold any of the copyrights, as was essentially the thing with publishing, so I don't think they did very well out of it at the time, despite its massiveness. But that's a story repeated all over the music industry of the period.
Yeah.
The B-side is a song called Dancing Shoes, which is actually sort of quite heavy in comparison to Summer Holiday. That's another Shadows written one, written by Bruce Welch and Hank Marvin. It's obviously out in Columbia. It's obviously produced by Norrie Paramore. And do you know what? Of all of the Cliff songs that you could have as a sort of one of your totem songs, one of your identifying ones, I think this is a really nice one. It's obviously the title song from the film.
Yeah.
Which is, itself was a huge hit. But it sort of has a job to do in that respect, I think. Mm. And I think it does it very well. So in terms of the background and the writing of it, Brian Bennett in an interview in 2018 was talking about it. Written in an hour, we were in Panto in Stockton-on-Tees in the northeast, Stockton again, up near Middlesbrough. We got notes through for another production, Summer Holiday, something about some young blokes driving through Europe on a double-decker bus.
Double-decker
bus. Weird to say. We were off to do the title track, but I nearly didn't do it. But Bruce persevered and came straight out with the first few bars. Then I just added, we're going where the sun shines brightly, we're going where the sea is blue, etc. All done and dusted in an hour and won an Ivor Novello Award for Best Song in a Film.
And isn't that often the way?
Well, yes. If I'd written a song in an hour that got an Ivor Novello, I'd be very happy. Yeah, and I've not really mentioned the film because I didn't get a chance to watch it again because I wanted to.
Again? I take it you've watched it before.
Well, I've watched it when I was much younger and it was on telly or something like that. But I did go on IMDb, I did do a little bit of research. I'm a big fan of the sorts of tedious things people add to IMDb comments, you know, like trivia and goofs and all that sort of stuff, because it can get really specific. But I like this. This is from the goofs section of Summer Holidays IMDb page.
Go on then.
Cliff and his mates are wearing the same clothes for 7 days during the bus repairs and remodelling.
It's just... Is that a goof or is that just bad hygiene?
Yes, you know.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah.
Summer holiday.
When I was watching and listening to this and watching a clip of it, what was it? I was watching a clip of it where he's kind of awkwardly eating a sandwich and driving the bus at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah. That was strange enough. I don't know if I've ever seen this on telly. Maybe when we were young, I've got no idea. But I think the vision of Cliff in a bus and that kind of thing is just kind of out there, isn't it, and part of the culture. But yeah, I don't know if I would sit and watch it. I don't know.
With your love of musicals.
Yeah, but I get intrigued. I get intrigued by them because we're diving into all this stuff, you know, and you think, well, what was it? But anyway, let's get on with the music scores for it. We're not here to do the Shadows, the Cliff Richard films. That would be a whole different bonus podcast. Can you imagine if that was series 5? Just all the Cliff Richard and Elvis films.
Oh my goodness.
God, it'd be like some kind of...
Maybe we'll do a special of one of them.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe we'll do this one as a special.
Yeah,
As an idea of a British thing.
Yeah, we could do an Elvis one and a Cliff. And what are we talking about? All right, let's get on with this. Anyway, so like I say, this is definitely his most well-known song, or up there with them, and it's, and or at least his most recognisable and memorable. And it's undeniably catchy, not just the melody, but the whole bendy guitar riff that brings it all in and comes back at times, you know, I presume Hank. Yeah, Marvin, yeah. Doing din 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 din. You're already onto a winner there, and then you have the infectious sing along melody, and it's one of those songs which I think is probably consistent with the written in an hour thing that unfolds exactly as it should do, yeah. Which very much has that thing that if you hit on the right idea, it's kind of paint by numbers, as in you would always go into that. It would sound wrong to go anywhere but the places it goes, which sounds like an obvious thing to say, but some songs are, you know, people try and subvert the fact that they try and resist where the ear wants you to go to subvert it and to do something different. But in this one, it's like, no, it's got to go to that now and that, and now go back to the instrumental bit. And the whole construction and arrangement is what you want. It's satisfying, as a satisfying cadence and progression to it. And it's only short, so it's only a little over 2 minutes. So it doesn't outstay its welcome, which I think for something kind of catchy and twee, you don't want it to. You wonder, it's one of these ones that makes me wonder how it seeps into culture, because mum and dad wouldn't have played it. I suppose it gets played on adverts, in children's shows, maybe we even...
It's been featured in lots of things because it's about a summer holiday, because it's got a theme. You know, it can be applied to other things.
It just becomes library music, doesn't it? Because it's so specific.
Yeah.
It's kind of cast the sound of what a summer holiday... If you're going to do any kind of feature on any kind of show, which is to do with a summer holiday, there's a good chance this will be the song that plays. I like the Shadows sound in this. The summer shuffle sound suits them. That was a hard sentence. The summer shuffle sound suits the Shadows specifically, especially with the added Glock. Is it Glock or?
Yeah, there's some sort of chime thing in it, isn't there? Like a vibraphone or something. But,
yes, I think it's vibraphone maybe. Yeah,
which I like. But there's a great bit when they first come in, they do like a two note thing, ba bing, and it sounds like someone's phone alert. It's so up front in the mix, and it doesn't have any reverb on it particularly. It sort of comes in and goes. It's like, was that my phone? I thought I had it on silent.
They just did it just to mess with us in 60 years' time.
Yep.
So, yeah. And you've got the inoffensive strings going along with it all. And yes, Cliff sings it in his usual pitch-perfect manner. There's no denying that Cliff can sing an extremely competent vocal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, maybe it doesn't have, like... bags of personality, but he sings the whole thing right. The main thing is this song isn't boring like some of the ones we had, I think, last week of his. It's twee to the extreme, but poppy and rightfully a hit. It's not something that I would seek out, if you know what I mean. It's just it there in the world then and exists, whether I like it or not. But I can't fault what it is too much. I've given it 57 for music.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously the Shadows with the Norrie Paramore strings and other bits and bobs as well. And there is a little attempt to sort of up the energy at the end by having a little modulation, but it doesn't really add much to sort of the energy there. I just think it's nicely arranged. It's a song that's doing a job and it's doing it well.
Yeah, in and out, job done, summer holiday. You know, staple of any kind of summer holiday music for the next however many hundreds of years. Sorted in an hour, blah, blah, blah. So, yes, onto production then. You've just said it. We've got the usual Norrie Paramore sheen on this.
Yep.
With that added vibraphone. But what I like in this is that the Shadows are sitting back and are more of a unit shuffling along because it's not about them. They feel a bit more... You know, they're always very clean and upfront, like sound. They're more mixed as a whole band kind of... Yeah, you're not hearing every tiny little note on the acoustic or anything because it's more compressed into a band space. Hank's reverb's been turned down a lot and replaced by that kind of very clean mid treble sound of his guitar for the bendy strings. It's not all awash in his feature. And, you know, I can't fault Hank too much because as someone who owns a Red Stratocaster and uses it on almost everything I do because it sounds great, I can't blame him for making a feature
of it. He didn't uniquely play a Red Stratocaster.
Did he not?
But it became his instrument that he's most associated with.
Yeah, he's quite famous.
He was one of the first, if not the first person to own one in the country.
Although he played like a matte Red Stratocaster, didn't he?
I don't know. He's all in black and white on the pictures.
True. Yeah, he played a black and white Stratocaster, didn't he? Whereas mine's like a candy apple red. Just looking at it now.
Stop looking at your guitar.
It's a very beautiful guitar.
This was recorded on the 5th of May, 1962. And the orchestra was added in November of the same year.
Very good. I've given it 55 for production. There's not much in it with the other Shadows and Cliff songs. You know, they're all fitting a very similar mould. But I like the overall summer shuffly vibe here. I like what they've gone for here. So that's the production. There's nothing else to add to it. No singing mice or anything strange.
Not on this one.
So, lyrics then. I mean, it's the ultimate sing-along on the bus song, isn't it? especially if you're actually going on a summer holiday on a bus. Not just any old bus to the city centre or something on
the 86 into town.
Yeah, not just going to Hanley on a rainy Tuesday. Although that could be exactly the kind of time you might want to escape into the reverie of this kind of song in your head. I would take issue that kind of A, everybody has a summer holiday, and yes. B, it does the things that they want to do when they're on it.
Yeah, so for 1962/63, yeah. To say that everybody had 2 weeks summer holiday is, I think, probably a stretch.
Probably. But, they may have had a summer holiday, but they probably weren't going on a bus.
They weren't going off
Europe.
Somewhere, yes, really sunny and, like, they weren't driving a bus across Europe.
No. And they're probably not going where the sea is blue. They might be getting on a coach to Margate or to...
To a holiday home in Margate.
To Blackpool or something like that.
Scarborough.
Sorry?
Scarborough.
To Scarborough. Yeah.
Where Which the sea, I love, but the sea is not blue.
It's not blue. It's kind of shades of brown and white foam. Yeah. We're going where there's chip fat is poured into the ocean. It's very nice and idyllic, isn't it, for the rose tinted film it's part of. I'm sure there must be. It occurred to me there must be some parody versions of this. You'd expect quite a famous parody version of this, but when I typed it in, nothing really came out.
No, I can't think of one off the top of my head. No, if there is any, I'm sure we've got listeners who will tell us.
Yeah, if you know of a good one, because I typed it in, I only did a very small amount of surface searching. I imagine that anything like, say anyone like, I'm thinking specifically the two Ronnies or someone like that had done any kind of a parody. I don't know if they did parodies, actually.
Did they do contemporary parodies? Yeah, but not in the early 60s.
No. I'm trying to think who would have done it. But even so, this song has enduring appeal. You know, it could have... But no, nothing came up apart from some people's own YouTube parodies, which weren't very good. So you'd expect nowadays you'd have something like We're All Going on a Package Holiday, or You Can Eat for a Week or Two.
I'm sure it must exist somewhere.
It must, mustn't it? But that sounds like the kind of thing Lad Baby would do, so let's leave it at that.
Yes. Move on.
36 for lyrics. 49 overall. Yeah, I don't mind this song existing.
No, it's fine.
Which is a compliment.
It's basically fine.
It's basically fine. Shall we move on to a completely different thing altogether whatsoever, Paul?
Yes, please.
Well, next we have The Shadows, Foot Tapper. Tapper, Paul.
Not if I can help it, because it'll get on the mic and you'll hear it and it'll be annoying.
Yes.
Okay, Foot Tapper is The Shadows. Yes, this is also from Summer Holiday in the sense that it plays on the radio on the bus and they have a dance to it.
Ah.
And so it ends up on the soundtrack album. Gets to number one on the 28th of March 1963 for 1 week. So this interrupts Cliff.
Yes.
And Cliff then goes back up to number one.
So I have a theory. I think I mentioned it last week or in the last couple of weeks at some point. That's starting to solidify my mind, is that people accidentally brought the Shadows stuff, not because they're not good, but every time Cliff has a hit, and then the Shadows have a hit, I think did just a bunch of people go in, not really read the cover properly, and come out and go, oh no, this isn't the one, this is just the Shadows.
I don't know.
There must have been at least a significant portion of people who did that by accident.
Like going out to buy a Transformer, but coming home with a GoBot.
Exactly.
The Shadows are not the GoBot of Cliff Richard and the Shadows.
No, right, yeah.
The Shadows are definitely the Transformers.
No,
Cliff Richard's not a GoBot.
It's not really like that. It'd be like that if there was another brand of toy called, like, if it was Transformers and the GoBots, and then you just saw the GoBots and didn't really look at the fact that there was no Transformers and
the top. I can feel people turning off this podcast in the air. Right, Foot Tapper by the Shadows.
Yeah.
Obviously, again, it's on Columbia. It's a Norrie Paramore production. This is written by Hank Marvin and Bruce Welch. It's an instrumental. The flip side is an instrumental called The Breeze and I, which is an instrumental of a vocal version of a song which was from the 20s and doesn't do it for me.
Okay.
The funny thing with Foot Tapper is apparently this was written for a film, but not Summer Holiday.
Right.
So it was written for the filmmaker Jacques Tati. French filmmaker asked them for a song for something he was making at the time, and then his production fell apart for finance reasons, and so it gets added to Summer Holiday.
Mm.
And the other weird thing about this as well is I was looking back through, like I usually do, through Disc and through some of the other things as well, and lots of places list this as being a double A-side, as in The Breeze and I and Foot Tapper supposed to equally chart, but they clearly don't, and it's not registered on the official charts that way.
Mm.
But like in the new Record Mirror review, it lists Foot Tapper, and in the Disc review, it lists The Breeze and I as the A-side.
Mm.
So it's it's not listed officially as a number one, but it obviously was potentially sold that way. But clearly Foot Tapper won out and got the spot.
Mm.
Either way, Gary,
yeah,
it's our last Shadows number one.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Ooh. We haven't had a last Cliff number one, though.
I wasn't going to reveal that information.
Oh, well, just don't. Just leave it hanging.
But you can be kissing goodbye to Hank Marvin, Bruce Welch, Brian Locking and Brian Bennett.
Ooh. Is that because they don't get it to number one again, or because they actually stopped being the Shadows? Again,
well,
am I jumping
both.
The gun?
Eventually, yeah, oh, both, I see. Of course. Yeah. But this is their last number one in our system.
Oh, okay. Well, bye-bye.
And I love it. It's a great way to go out. It's a great tune.
Yeah, the problem with instrumentals when I'm looking through the kind of names of the songs is that I never know what they are until, obviously, I put them on and go, ah, it's this one, because nothing about the word Foot Tapper to me links to din 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 din. But, you know, it's just the one that goes do di do di do di. But you can't call every instrumental song do di do di do di, can you? So
no, you cannot.
I'm constantly surprised by how many instrumentals the British public were buying and how many the Shadows got. You know, it's not something, they're obviously very good and that's why, but it's not a phenomenon that we really, is it something we've really seen since, apart from, you know, for number ones in the kind of main chart? Instrumental bands didn't become a thing, did they, really? They were.
No, I think it's only happened a few times that an instrumental has ever got to number one after the Shadows, I would have thought.
Yeah.
Although I can't think off the top of my head particularly. I suppose it depends how you look at what people wanted out of their music at any one time. And obviously, there's a reason singers exist. It's because people can make a connection with a voice very easily in a way that you don't necessarily with an instrument, no matter how well it's played. So it's an interesting thing. But then if you think about the rise of like electronic dance music and stuff like that,
yeah, but
that serves a different purpose and sort of achieves its success via this different, appealing to a different part of your human body, as it were. So there's all sorts of reasons that you could probably get into for this.
Yeah, it's just an interesting, just think about it. It's like, yeah, there's not, They didn't kind of start. They just kind of lived in their own space there, didn't they? Inhabited for a while, and then they were gone. Although they never really went away.
No, but I mean, it is interesting because they are, again, I keep using totemic or emblematic or iconic of British rocks, perhaps not the right word, British pop music at the time is the Shadows. And, it's Cliff and the Shadows.
And we're kind of seeing the passing of the torch.
Maybe.
But to whom? But anyway, for this final tune of theirs, it rollicks along quite nicely. It's typically hooky and, as they say, toe-tapping. Or foot tapping, even.
The whole foot's going.
The whole foot, more than just the
toe. Like the clappers.
There are some flabby sections where, which we've had before. I think if it was to criticise old Hank with his beautiful black and white Stratocaster, it's the fact that sometimes he could just not play in some of the bars. Like when he's not doing the main bit. And then it goes into a section where he's like going ding, ding, ding. Ding, ding, ding. Ding, 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 ding. You know, and that, he just kind of needs to, he could just play less in some of the moody bits, I think. But I think that's the problem sometimes without a singer. He feels like he has to play constantly. Whereas normally you could swap between the song, the voice and the maybe the a instrumental bridge. But it's only a small point. And actually in this one, for the outro, the drums get to do a bit of soloing as well, don't we?
Yeah, they're not quite on the full Jet Harris, Tony Meehan solo thing, but Brian Bennett's drumming on this is great.
Yeah, it's funny coming out of the back of the Jet Harris, Tony Meehan thing last week that we get the Shadows bringing their drummer forwards a little bit.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah,
It makes you wonder, doesn't it? Did they just think we should do some more drummy bits?
Maybe. It would have been recorded about the same time, I think.
Yeah. And you wonder when you hear that, why didn't they do a bit more of bass and drums breaking up Hank's lead? So it wasn't a bit like Hank has to be playing all the way through, because actually it gives it some more light and shade when that you do that. But anyway, that aside, it's another catchy little Shadows number, a bit of a ditty, you know. 54 I've given it for music.
My favourite thing is that it's got one of those, what sounds like a really clanky tambourine on it.
Right.
As have several of the Shadows and Cliff things. But it's actually a thing called a sistrum.
Sistrum. Sounds like something you'd have in plumbing.
Yes, it does sound like that. But if you think of like the round metal rattly things that you have on a tambourine, a sistrum, and there's all different varieties of sistrum, but it's basically got those, but it's in a more of a square framework that you can hold with a handle and shake.
Right.
So it's like a sort of alternative shaped tambourine. It's a bit clankier sounding, but that's sometimes when you think it's a tambourine, it's actually a sistrum.
Okay. Fair enough. So hang on. Have I got a sistrum?
I don't know.
The half moon shaped things?
No. Like a square thing, like a framework on a handle.
Right. No, I think I know what you mean. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go on to the production then, Paul, where we can talk about the sistrum and more if you wish. Because here we are for the final time talking about Shadow production, the Shadows production again.
Yes.
I don't really have much else to say about this that we haven't said, obviously, several times already.
We're listening in mono as well,
yeah.
Really, which is the primary mix for this. And it is a bit cloudy, I think, as a mix. But I did hunt down a stereo version that was officially released on a reissue, one of the Shadows compilations. And it's this stereo version's rubbish because everything's too separate. So actually, if you imagine turning this up loud, you know.
Yeah. So I preferred this to Dance On from last week, because last week I was saying I couldn't quite work out if I liked the fact that everything's so cleanly treated that I can hear the acoustic so well, because actually this all blends better for me as one band again, which is like what we just said about the Summer Holiday song, that the Shadows felt more of a unit rather than four different instruments being recorded at the same time. I don't know if that's hard to explain. And again, I don't think he's out there too much with his reverb this time, so I thought this blended together just a little bit better.
Yeah.
Almost like they kept the settings from the last song we listened to and just launched into this. Like, see you, Cliff. You guys aren't going to record anything without me, are you? No, no. See you later, Cliff. We're not going to just quickly record a new hymn and knock you off number one for a week. Because it feels like they've got the same settings and just launched into this. You know?
Yeah. Like, they feel like a decent heavy pop production at this point.
Yeah.
You know, when he's not doing those long, melodic, super clean, twangy things, it does feel like they are a pretty heavy band.
Yeah. But then, you know, maybe it was just too much and that's why it turned everybody off and this was the last they did. But I'm giving it 55 for production, which gives it 55 overall because we don't have any lyrics, which means by default it does really well.
Yes. And of course it was the theme tune for the radio programme Sounds of the 60s.
Yes.
So during the time that Brian Matthews presented it, which was like from 1983 to 2017.
Right.
It was a long-running show, which was kind of essentially a radio show forerunner of the sort of thing we're doing here, looking at the 60s.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a long tradition of going over something that's been...
Gone over many times.
But with our unique take on it.
Yes.
So you look at the next lot.
Yeah. Do you know what? I'm bored of being down south with Cliff and the Shadows. Let's do something else.
Let's see where else we can go. Next we have Jerry and the Pacemakers. How do you do it?
You give me a feeling in my heart, like an arrow passing through it. Suppose that you think you're very smart.
How do you do it, Paul?
I just sit down and start talking, Gary, and gold pours forth from my throat.
Okay.
caught myself out saying that. That was such a stupid thing to say. Anyway, guess what? Liverpool group at the top of the charts.
A bit of Mersey beat coming in.
The Mersey beat. Yeah. Jerry and the Pacemakers with How Do You Do It? The song the Beatles rejected.
Mm.
And probably would have been rejected on their behalf, or not on their behalf, by the songwriter.
Yes.
Anyway, as we've discussed before.
Mm.
So this gets to number one on the 11th of April, 1963. Spends 3 weeks at number one, so that's not a bad start for Jerry and Co. And as we've said, it's written by Mitch Murray. We've talked about this before. The B-side is a song called Away From You, which is written by two of the Pacemakers, Jerry Marsden and Les Chadwick. And it's got too many chords and is not great. But this comes out on Columbia, so it's obviously within EMI. And George Martin is listed as the producer, even though he's a Parlophone producer. But it's probably actually Ron Richards who produced it, even though George's name is on it, because Jerry comes to him through Brian to George to EMI. So you can find interviews with Ron Richards saying, I actually produced this one, even though George's name is on it.
Yeah.
And we've got one of those rare occasions now where I can say that this gets to number nine in America, but not until it's reissued in 1964.
Okay.
So we're familiar with that from Beatles stories. But yeah, Jerry and the Pacemakers, not the Pacemakers, not Jerry Marsden with band. You know, in the background, it's just Jerry and the Pacemakers, something the Beatles were never.
Yeah.
Really, you know, apart from brief Johnny and the Moondogs moment. But I'm glad the song came out. I'm glad Jerry got to do it because he does it in his unique sort of... Unique's not... That makes me sound like I'm being rude. I'm not. You know, he's got this personality, hasn't he? But, yeah, it's always funny with this sort of someone and the someones.
Mm.
It's obviously a thing that's hung around a long time. Still, you know, people still do it. And we've got Jerry Marsden. We've got Freddie Marsden, his older brother, who drums.
Right.
Jerry's obviously on guitar and vocals. We have Les McGuire on piano. And we have Les Chadwick on bass. It's a band, double Les band. Two Marsdens, two Leses. And sadly, none of them are with us anymore.
Oh.
which is a shame. And Les Maguire, the piano player, only passed away in November of 2023, and I think I missed that news, which is that's quite sad. He was a bit more of a jazzy background, which I think explains the
you can tell that.
Sound of, yeah. of the piano on this. But what I do really like about this is the piano being part of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, but before we get to music, Jerry is the heart and soul of the band, obviously. So he's from a part of Liverpool that was Toxteth, sort of Toxteth Dingle area, which is down towards the waterfront a bit more. The street he was born on isn't there anymore. It's been bulldozed and a new estate built on top of it. And he apparently had a group, you know, when he came out of the skiffle craze, he formed a group called Jerry Marsden and the Mars Bars. Mm. And it says everywhere, like in obituaries for him and the others and da-da-da, says that they changed the name when the Mars Company complained, the makers of Mars Bar.
Right.
But they
weren't famous at that point.
They weren't famous. They weren't a signed band. Why would the makers of Britain's chocolate bar, the Mars Bar, be like, well, there's some teenagers in a skiffle group in Liverpool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a joke.
People are going to get us confused.
Yeah. They'll be suing the planet next, won't they?
Yeah. So anyway, I don't know where that's from, but it's quoted everywhere. It seems bonkers. The Pacemakers still tour, despite the fact that I have said that they're all dead.
Right.
But yeah, Jerry was obviously out with a version of the band for most of his career, really, other than the brief period, after they broke up.
Ship of Theseus type of thing, is it? Where
Trigger's Broom, yeah. It's so I think most of the people who are in the band now, I think, were only... like, they were with him for a little bit before he died. The band sort of vanished a little bit, and then they came back as Jerry's Pacemakers.
Right, okay.
But I think they're all basically people who joined in essentially the 2020s.
Right.
So, but there you go. That's who you'd see if you went and saw them still now.
There will be a point, won't there, where... because we're still, in 2024, living in the legacies of... you know, it's unusual for absolutely everybody to be dead still, even this far down the line.
Yes.
Without there being a member who joined later, and therefore, even though the original lineup is dead, there was one who was with them when they did their hit later on, and so they've got this kind of baton passing.
But there's a lot of like bands with members who became like bands from the 60s who had members that joined in the 70s who are still in the band and have clearly then been in the band 40, 50 years.
Yeah.
But
there will be a point where more like that with Jerry and the Pacemakers, really. Although there's some...
Jerry, I think Jerry is a bit more like, this is a whole new bunch of people. But there are lots of, you know, the last remaining one of so-and-so and so-and-so.
Yeah,
and...
we'll live through, really. There'll be no original lineup members yet at all, won't there, you know? And it'll just be people who kind of have...
Well, it's one thing that happened a lot with those American vocal harmony groups, isn't it, that still tour... And it sort of became the original group, and then they'd have a few members replaced, and then perhaps a son or someone would replace the father, and then so on, and it would move and change and that sort of stuff.
But in some way, something is passed, like the oral tradition, isn't it? Something is passed through there. As long as there's not a clean break, like a fire break between two iterations of the band, as long as there is any kind of handover, something is being passed even beyond those people's lifetime, isn't there? I was taught by the person who was taught by kind of thing.
Yeah.
To play this song, and this is it's interesting that. It's an interesting thought, really.
Yes.
We might have an actual fully generational kind of versions of bands that could be gone hundreds of years because and they would still have some kind of tangible link.
If we had a time machine and we zipped forwards to the year 2525, we could get out and find the first person we could. Are the Pacemakers still going?
Yeah. And can you provide us with the full lineage? Anyway, that just set me off on one.
But yeah, this is, you know, the funny thing is, obviously, this is, in terms of our chart, this is the first Liverpool group of the type we're thinking of to have a hit.
Yes.
But of course, they're being reported in the paper, like Disc magazine, in March of 1963. Another Liverpool group breaks into the charts this week, because obviously this is in the wake of the Beatles. Albeit not on our charting.
So that's the thing that's strange for us, because we've not yet heard the Beatles.
Yeah, who? Beatles who?
Exactly. And it's It's a funny one, really, with that, how that we didn't get to hear them because of them not being number one in the chart. Because actually, this is taking that, for me, is starting to take that mantle of being a bit like, oh, this is a bit different.
Yes, definitely.
This is coming out a bit out there compared to what we've been listening to. You know, a huge amount of Blooming Cliff in the Shadows and Elvis. I'm not surprised people would get into a point now of, well, come on. Especially the kids, if they weren't the ones who were driving maybe the sales of all that stuff. And they're suddenly like, come on, we want something for us. This is a bit more like it. A bit of beat music with some drive and some energy, you know.
Yeah,
that
totally.
Sound, that
and it's another group who's done their apprenticeship in Hamburg, yeah, and stuff like that, and done this exactly the same, more or less, as the Beatles.
Yeah, they're tight, you know.
Yeah, it's just a lot harder to drag a piano around.
Yeah, but they really attack this nicely, and Jerry's voice suits it brilliantly. The piano solo is great, and in general pads out the song nicely throughout. It must have been back in series two, was it, when we talked about, it was not the songs that gave away. We would have done it in series three, which was the anthology and Bits and Bobs, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We talked about this. And so obviously there's the Beatles. So if you want to listen to us talk about it in detail, you know, go back to series three and find our episode where we covered the Beatles version they recorded. But it's always interesting to listen to this against the Beatles version, because this is clearly the better version.
It is the better version, because the Beatles version, much as I love it, and I do, because I love Beatles harmonies, and there's no harmony in this at all,
no,
in the vocals, they do sound like they're just trying to get it over with.
Yeah, this is faster, it's attacked with enthusiasm, and suits his voice better than John's, to be honest, frankly, this song. In that
very different voices.
Yeah, in the performance of it, I mean. You know, like you say, it could have suited John's voice if he wanted it to, maybe. And the solo is better on piano, though George has a good bash on it. The drums are better, you know, the solo sounds better, the piano sounds better, which obviously isn't in the Beatles version. I think in here, the drums are better placed and performed in the Pacemakers version. And I think what you hear is the Beatles' lack of interest in doing someone else's song when they really want their own out there. And in this, I think you hear a band going, yeah, we'll do it. We'll show you how we can do it. We're really going to grasp the nettle with it, as it were, and make a good go of it. Did we talk about before, would they have been aware and heard the Beatles version? Do we know?
I think so. I think
so. They might have had a template of, well, let's not do it like that. Not all together, but they might have gone, I could do it being a bit faster, and that bit doesn't work as well. And
yeah. I mean, the sound is just so different, because the piano, apart from doing the solo, is playing, is being like a rhythm guitar as well.
Yeah.
But it's been a rhythm guitar where you can have lots of bassy sound as well as the higher sounds in it. So
yeah,
even though they haven't got two guitars, and Jerry essentially plays rhythm on his, you've got just this huge block rhythm sound tonally in the middle of it, which gives it this real sort of weight.
Mm. I think it fills in a gap that's definitely there in the Beatles one. And actually, although, like you say, I like the Beatles harmonies in general, I like this without that harmony. I think as a choice for this song, it's better for that melody hook. Sounds better.
Well, that's what Mitch Murray thought as well when he heard the Beatles version. I think one of his complaints was it doesn't need a harmony.
Yeah.
Now, I love the harmony because I think it doesn't detract from the melody, but that was what Mitch Murray was saying.
Well,
I think the melody's strong enough.
Yeah, I think I'm with Mitch Murray on this one. Me and Mitch. I've given it 59 for music.
Okay.
I like this. I like it. I've always liked this song anyway, but now I've listened to it as a kind of emerging from what we've been listening to. You're thinking, here we go. We're getting there. Production, think it sounds great. The bass rolls are along nicely and the drums are sitting back nicely and coming through when needed with all the little hits and builds they've worked out. There's a lot of good drumming in this. And even though the band is attacking the song, it's all handled nicely in the sound envelope. Jerry's voice is nicely treated, enhancing his already pleasant tone. I think it kind of works nicely with his vocal tone. I think the piano comes through great in the solo and as that kind of like that, like you said, that kind of central block of sound rhythmically that works. It's a sound that feels vibrant, it rooted in performance. You know, it feels like a band who can play live and do play live, playing really well together.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's, and again, they're in Abbey Road with producers who are getting used to this type of sound, but because it is a slightly different sound, like we said, to, you know, if you have the Shadows in and then the Pacemakers, they're not the same thing, even if they're using the same type of instruments.
Yeah.
Like the bass guitar is much heavier on this than a lot of the records we've heard.
Mm.
But they get it and they capture it well. But like you say, his voice is allowed to do its job.
Mm.
And he has Jerry's voice. Jerry Marsden's voice is Jerry Marsden's voice. It's not like anyone else's.
No.
It's got a real personality.
Yeah, and sound. This is a great song for him. I've given it 63 for production. I think it's a good sounding song.
Just sort of on a side note for production, obviously, we've always talked about how in America they wouldn't put out the Beatles singles on Capitol, even though that was owned by EMI. Same thing here. So this does get put out in America at the time to no success on a label called Lorry, which was an independent label in New York. So again, you can have this as a number one, the Beatles as number one, or whatever. And at the time, America was just not interested. Interested later, though, weren't they?
Yeah.
Playing catch up.
Yeah, you want us now, don't you? Well, you can't have us. No, actually, you can have them all.
Yes.
I suppose, you know, when it's not a passing, at this point, this could all still just be a passing phase, couldn't it?
Yeah, true.
You know, not even passing it at this point, just kind of emerging. We could have been past it, could be it. So this kind of Mersey sound and Mersey beat and stuff. So, right, lyrics then. Who wrote this again? Oh, it was...
Mitch
Murray, yeah. Did he write it all, the whole...
Yeah, yeah. So he apparently his method of writing is to sit with a ukulele and play it, which, given it's essentially four chords, more or less, you can understand. And he's also, basically, Mitch's career later than this is essentially as a speechwriter and comic speechwriter.
Oh, so he's
got a little sort of a bit of wit to it.
And you can tell it in this. It's a neat line, isn't it? Some good words, really. How do you do what you do to me? I wish I knew. If I knew how you do it to me, I'd do it to you. On paper, it kind of looks horrendous, almost like Bilbo Baggins' backhanded compliment on his 111th birthday.
Yeah.
You have to kind of track it through, but it all checks out. There's just lots of do's and you's, and you'd think, that can't be a good lyric. But when you string it together in this song, it does work, doesn't it?
It's a lyrical hook.
Yeah. I wish I knew. If I knew how you do it to me.
And also, it's a bit naughty in its own way.
Yes.
Because it doesn't ever say what the doing is.
Yeah.
The thing that is being done.
What are you saying? I just presumed they meant be your lovey, loving.
Well, it is. That's what it means, if that's what you want it to mean.
What else could it mean?
I don't know. I don't know.
Naughties.
It sure does.
But, and then, there's not much actually else to it. There's the only other section is the one verse, really, isn't there? There's only one verse, which is the you give me a feeling in my heart like an arrow passing through it. I suppose that you think you're very
well,
smart.
That's the B section, that, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's a
line inversion that I quite like. You know, you wouldn't normally say an arrow passing through it. You'd say like I suppose you might do. Well, you wouldn't say... You gave me a feeling in my heart like an arrow passing through it. You'd say, I've got a feeling like an arrow's passed through my heart, wouldn't you? You wouldn't say...
Well, you would.
I would, if I was going to say that. But it works really well to kind of get back to the do it again. How do you do it? But, it's some solid pop lyrics. I've given it 56 for lyrics, which gives it 59 altogether.
Okie doke.
Creeping up on things... Anything else to say about old Jerry?
But we will be talking about Jerry and the Pacemakers again, so I'll save stuff for the future.
That will be nice. I think I might know what that might be. Well, I might be wrong. So, finally. Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Beatles. From me to you. to you, Paul.
Thank you, Gary. That's a very generous gift of music you have given me.
That's all right.
Thank you. You're my friend. Okay. They've arrived, and to prove it, they're here. Oh, we've been waiting for this for ages. And it's from me to you, which is, I don't know. I mean, when you think of the Beatles, and someone said, name five Beatles songs, go. Would you name From Me to You? I don't know. But it's a huge smash, and it's brilliant. It's, I don't know. We talked about this. Now, we're not going to go back and re-litigate your episode when we first did it in series one.
No.
But safe to say, we did this in episode 5.
Right, very early.
Of the first series, which was in October of 2020. So we haven't thought about this for ages, really.
Blimey, okay. I think it's worth a bit of the context. So if anyone has come to us late on and not gone through all of series one, which is highly possible.
Especially not those early episodes where we didn't know what we were doing.
Where we were still feeling a way to do it. Like Paul's just said, we're not going to go back to my scores from that, because the whole scoring for series one was about me thinking just about the Beatles, with a vague notion of where I thought some of the lower ones would be and where the higher ones would be, not against the all of 60s music. So we're going to neglect isn't the right word. We're going to
ignore those
scores from before, and I have rescored them for this chart. And also, they were in random order, weren't they? So when Paul says episode 5, because we were doing all the Beatles songs, we were doing them in random order, so we didn't just keep on having to go through the same era, you know.
Yeah.
So that also had a bearing on it all as well, doesn't it? So whereas now we're going to hear them in their kind of developmental order.
Yeah. So let me give you the facts again then. So From Me to You by the Beatles becomes number one on the 2nd of May 1963. And it spends 7 weeks at number one. And as we know, basically, if you get to 7 or 8 weeks, you are a superstar smash hit record.
Yeah.
You know, that's an insanely long time in the 60s to be number one. And this is produced by George Martin, engineered by Norman Smith, with Richard Langham as the tape operator. It's a Lennon-McCartney composition. The B-side is Thank You Girl, which was another sort of, could this be the single? We don't know yet. Mm. Obviously, it's on Parlophone. It gets to number 41 in America in 1963 by the time people have sort of cottoned on. It's, you know. But this is a written-to-order song, which I think is worth keeping in mind.
Right.
Obviously, like, they arrive at EMI as a band that's played hours and hours and hours and can play for hours and hours and hours of some of their own stuff.
Yeah.
But mainly covers. They're pushing their own stuff, but they don't have this massive amount of songs like people think they had, you know, that could just step up and be, oh, this is definitely a single, that's definitely a single, or whatever. So they write this to order, because we need another single now, lads.
Yeah.
So this is one that they write a bit like the Shadows with the Summer Holiday. It's like, well, what are we going to do? Well, we're on a coach from York to Shrewsbury, across the country, sideways. And we need to write a song. This is the Helen Shapiro tour.
Mm.
So let's start. Right, mess around with the chords a bit. What you got? John starts with a line inspired by the letters page in The Enemy, From Us to You.
Mm.
Or From You to Us, presumably, if it's a letters page. I must have written that down wrong. I don't know. I haven't got that copy of The Enemy near. And they've written the song by the end of it. So
right.
that coach trip. What's interesting is apparently the issue of The Enemy that they're talking about has their name on the cover twice, because the cover is a huge promotional wraparound for Arthur Howe's tours. So it's like it's advertising Helen Shapiro and the Beatles, and then later it's advertising Tommy Rowe and Chris Montez and the Beatles as well. But they're not featured in it as like a big act with loads of coverage inside the actual issue. But that's just an interesting thing as well.
Mm.
So written to order, and next single, sorted.
Yeah, right. Well, that's that then. I'll go back over music. I've just done my notes anew. I haven't gone back to my old one, so I'm sure we'll cover some ground here, but who cares? So, This is a... I think, you know, there is a lot of... We've been waiting for this moment, and it's kind of like, where's this landed from? It's not necessarily come from outer space, this. Not now we've just had Jerry and the Pacemakers.
No.
To kind of, you know, prepare the ground for us as this, with this kind of Merseybeat sound. And the fact that we know this isn't their first single, and actually they were already quite popular by this point, but we've not seen it in our kind of scope. But it still does, compared to everything we've been listening to for the last 15 weeks, it is like, ah, right, okay, we're on to something now, aren't we?
Yes.
You know, I mean, we've got John singing, and I mean singing from his throat. He's not a crooner, but then we have this other chap who's harmonising with him, who does seem to be able to do a bit of the crooner quality, and, you know, is able to go into the kind of slightly higher falsetto, kind of strong falsetto voice, and they both hit that kind of woo note here and there, like, you know, and it's like you always get the feeling they're going, well, we could do that kind of thing if you want us to, you know, but we're not at the moment. And actually, having heard the context of a bit of Frank Ifield, with their little jump up the scales with their woos and their anything I can do top high harmony, you think, oh, you know, they're not the first people doing a little bit of high
stretching the range
stuff. And in a savvy way, I don't mean like stealing it. I mean, they're hearing that. They're thinking, yeah, that's a nice little flourish. We can put a bit of that in there. I mean, what's the story behind them sticking in the woos into things?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? It's because if you look at that first block of Beatles singles, you can pick out features.
Yeah.
Which is what makes Love Me Do kind of stand alone.
Yeah.
Because Love Me Do has the harmonica, obviously, but it doesn't have the... energized Little Richard style woos,
yeah,
which they kind of make into a slightly more polished studio thing, and make their own by like having these harmony woos and oohs and things. But it's because they know that by this point, if they're doing it on stage, it's sending people into absolute, you know, madness. Yeah. When they shake their head and go woo, so they're going to build it into their songs. So it's, you know, they are aware of their own trademarks, even this early, the trademarks being this particular Merseybeat sound with, and yes, I know we can go into whether Merseybeat's really a thing or not, but there is obviously something to identify it. But this Merseybeat sound with that sort of guitar, that sort of bass, but then it's the Beatles things, the harmonica at this point, and the vocal sound. And they know it, and they can use it, so fold it into your songwriting.
It's mad. And, yeah, they're bringing all these elements we know people like from what the best bits of what's been going on anyway with their new, with this new edge to it, a little bit more raw and raunchy. And you've got something that's very exciting. Not forgetting, like we said, that we've already had Love Me Doing Please Me, haven't we? But just not at this official top spot. And... and just the little touches like the singing of the intro theme along with the harmonica, just to add interest and accessibility. Anyone can go da 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 da, can't they? Anyone can do that, whether you know the rest of the words or not. It's from the off, you can sing along to it.
Yeah, instantly. Thank George Martin for that.
Was he the one who said sing along to it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we know that George Martin and the Beatles, you know, it was a relationship that needed all of them working together.
Yeah.
And then we have the verses where we can get a little bit sincere. It's clever, that little shift in dynamics as they talk about holding you and keeping you tight. And they're a little, you know, they can bring it down a little bit and kind of almost pick you out of the audience and start talking to you directly. Musically, the band are tight and not doing too much. George's little licks and fills are just enough, but they're keeping it solid at this early stage. It's letting the vocals and the harmonica do most of the work, isn't it, at this point? It's not a big... guitar-led thing as far as the lead bits. And now I've heard this in the context of the 60s build-up, it does it make me think in this one song you can hear the potential of this band and what they were now on the way to becoming? So that's what I'm trying to think about now. We're hearing it in chronological order. And yes, definitely. But having just come off of the Jerry song, it's also clear they're not the only horse in the race at this point.
True.
And that's interesting too. Because they're not just, there's just a load of dross and then the Beatles are there. Certainly not, you know. There's a lot of the samey kind of stuff. We've been in a bit, I feel like we've been in a bit of a rut, not with the podcast, but with the certain types of songs we've been having to hear every week.
Yeah.
And, but just because the Jerry one was there, and I imagine there's some other ones that aren't hitting number one as well around them. You know, at this point, it feels like they could have fizzled out after this one.
Yeah.
You never know. The next one could have been a clanger, but it wasn't. That's the thing. So, you know, I would be, at the time, I'm trying to put myself in that space, and I'm thinking, I'd be liking them, and I'd be thinking, hey, these are good. But if I hadn't lived in Liverpool and known all of that build-up to it, I would have been thinking, yeah, these are good, but those are good too. And, you know, I'll listen to them both, and, you know, I won't go mad just yet. So I've given it 60 for music is a strange way of taking me into that score.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's about these chords in the song and the fact that Paul McCartney was always, when he's talked about this, he's always said that when they shift into that second section.
Yes, yeah, into the sincere section.
You know, because you've got chords that are like, can you hear this?
Mm-hmm.
All very simple chords, but then they're in the key of C, but the second section starts on a G minor seventh, which is not an obvious thing to do. Like that, and it's quite unusual. And then it's just throwing in all those little things like the augmented.
Yeah.
And then even in the outro, like they, as they go to finish off the song, it's just all these little touches.
It is clever. And I perhaps take some of those things for granted because they're just so familiar with it, actually.
Yeah, and it all whizzes by in such a short space of time as well. I mean, I'll say my thing for this is in that middle section is when you get Paul and John harmonising, then they come together in unison,
yeah,
and then they split off again. It's so exciting.
It's very good. I mean, they're not bad, these boys. So 60 for music, I've given it for, you know, leaving headway. There's all the 60s to go yet.
There certainly is.
You know, and I know there's a load of purists out there. I'm not saying purists, but like, I did say purists, but what I mean is there are people who absolutely love the early stuff because of everything it represents and what it is. But, you know, for me, because of my
scores. I can't believe you're starting to apologise already.
For me, well, for people who didn't hear Series 1, really, you'll understand that for me, really, like, you've got to leave headroom for some of the music they do later on, because there's so much to come. There's so much crazy, amazing things to happen that I just, you know, I'm going to leave a bit of headroom. Production-wise, this is where it gets a bit tricky. Because we've got some great production up to now, and I'm now putting this against the number ones that have come to this point. When we were doing this against the Beatles stuff, it was about what they'd done to this point and things. And I have a lot wound up with my love for the Beatles, and this is good, but it's not as great as a lot of the other production we've heard to date, is it?
I think it's got some issues if you're going to be critical about it. If you do real critical listening, like one of them is that the bass guitar sounds dreadful.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they're using a makeshift amplifier that the engineers and technicians in EMI had to pull together to compensate for McCartney's terrible equipment. And even this sounds quite farty, to be honest, at times. Even if it does, I think the mono mix, which is the one that has the harmonica at the start, unlike the weird later stereo mix which misses it out. It's funny because it is a studio construction as a song as well. This is not one they've been playing and rehearsing.
No,
they build this in the studio over initially 7 takes, during which in those 7 takes only a couple of them are full versions and don't have the solo section in it until George Martin says, why not do this, stick a solo in there. And it doesn't have the harmonica part until they overdub loads, which is unusual for 1963 as well. And people will maybe have heard some of the early takes. So take 1, take 2 and take 5 are officially available to listen to on the Beatles Bootleg Recordings 1963 compilation, which was at one point a limited release just to secure copyright on these old things.
Yes, yeah.
But like, it's on Apple Music at least. I don't know if it's on Spotify, so you can go and hear some of these early takes. of this as well. And then everything on top of the, of those takes is edit pieces to generate new take numbers. But there are things like them doing the da-da-da-da-da-dum-dum-da.
Yeah.
Or adding the harmonica or adding little guitar flourishes and stuff.
Yeah.
So it is, yeah, it's a studio construct. It's stuck together.
But yeah, but it's you know, they are, despite being on the up, they're still against the clock and not with loads of resources, and it's still early technology and they're still new, aren't they? So, you know,
totally,
there is a bit of it's all pushed. It's a little peaky when they're both singing, the loud bits. The guitars are a little indistinct to the bass. The bass and drums sound good in general. I like the slight slide sound of Paul's bass. It's got a bit of a kind of the, I don't know if it's the way he's playing it, he kind of slides up to the notes a bit here.
Yeah, it is.
But
yeah.
The harmonica's nice, and doubling it with the low guitar note, as we know, there's bits of like that, you know, in the it plays along, don't they? They double up and the,
yeah, it's like the please me thing, yeah.
And singing along with it in the intro, that bit of production is obviously some clever touches. George M was obviously keeping his ear out for where to push it along a bit, and that all makes sense from what you've said about it being a studio construct. It's a hard one to balance in that I like the driven sound of it, but is it kind of better than the Jerry and the Pacemakers song we just listened to, which feels a little bit...
Well, this is up to you, Gary.
Well, I think that one feels a little bit clearer and distinct than this when I listen to them back to back. It's got a different type of energy, and this probably wins it on energy, but from a production point of view, so I'm giving this 58 for production, which is I think reflective of kind of where they're at, really.
Okie doke, that's fine.
It's still better than a lot of stuff, but it's not never at this stage going to be as good as the kind of bands that have all that resource. Absolutely, they're absolutely kind of clear bets that they're going to put a lot of resource behind. So yeah, 58 for production. Lyrics then, it's a great, as a song, to bring in the fans and keep them.
Yeah.
I mean, they're literally saying, I've arms that long to hold you and keep you. And you can call on me whenever you want. It's all very much, like Paul said himself, they're talking directly to the fans, aren't they?
Yeah, this and the flip side, because Thank You Girl was called Thank You Girl, because they knew of the type of people who'd be listening.
Yeah. Taken as a song to a person rather than to a homogenous mass of people, though, it's kind of very romantic and fawning, perhaps, but you know, not in a terrible way. And it's not unusual and out of sorts with really what we've heard from their contemporaries up to this point, is it? It's
no,
not doing anything particularly mad. It's finding a nice little niche way into a song to give it a reason to exist. And they carries it along. It's safe. It's not pushing any boundaries at this early stage.
Although I would say that line. So you have a line about wanting to kiss someone,
yeah,
which is quite sort of like, oh, but then it's and keep you satisfied, and then you have that woo.
Ooh,
I mean, that's like that to me is the sort of edgy, if you want to say that. That's a little bit, you know, that's where it cuts through on a couple of levels.
I see. Once again, for your dirty, filthy mind.
Oh yeah, mucky Beatles with Paul Abbott.
I just thought you meant like, you know, by being nice, coming home on time when they said he will, making dinner, helping out with the household chores. Is that not what you mean?
Do you listen to like old blues songs and think, oh, you just wanted to put some sugar in the bowl? That's all. That's all that happened there.
Yeah. I'm a picture of innocence. Yes, I guess there's that. But then we have had songs a couple of weeks ago. It's like, come out, shout for a bit of Slap and Tickle. You know what I mean?
Oh, well, yeah, but that was...
It wasn't exactly subtle, was it? It wasn't like the British public was... It wasn't like with Victorians, even though they were definitely more prudish, perhaps, than now. I suppose it's about being done in the right kind of way. If you do it with a bit of a wink and a nod, it's kind of all right. But if you do it where it's like, oh, they might mean it. Like, I don't know. I feel safe to me. I've given it 48 for lyrics. I don't think that's the thing that's really massively pushing it out there. I think it's everything over altogether. It gives it 55 overall.
Okay.
So, you know, and remember, everybody listening, that these scores are very, very hard to do in any way consistently. So that's how it, that we've done. We've done.
Okay. The Beatles are here.
Beatles have arrived. I wonder how long it'll be before they're back again. And how long it will go where they're not around.
Well.
I really do wonder that. I really don't know, because I've never really sat and thought about the timeline of it all. I'm not that way inclined. That's why I have you for, Paul.
You're just like, you're born anew every week, aren't you?
I forget a lot of things. So, this week, only one didn't make it into the top 20. It's only been a four-song episode, but only one of those didn't make it into the top 20. Do you know what one that was, Paul?
Was it... I can't remember what the scores were. So, if I see, you're born anew every week. I'm born anew every
second.
30 seconds
no,
or something.
The only one that didn't make it into the top 20 was Summer Holiday, which was number 29.
Okay.
That didn't quite make it. So, we'll do a top 20 and we'll see who did make it and where. It might be a bit... Yeah, let's see what we do. Okay.
Believe in yourself, Gary.
I know. I've suddenly remembered as I'm talking that, like, you know, at least quite a few hundred people listen to this. Yeah. And a lot of them are really big Beatles fans.
Just get on with
it. Okay, here we go. At number 20, Elvis Presley, Are You Lonesome Tonight? At number 19, Return to Sender, Elvis Presley. At number 18, The Highwaymen, Michael. At number 17, Nut Rocker, Bee Bumble and the Stingers. At number 16, Elvis Presley, It's Now or Never. At number 15, The Shadows, Foot Tapper. At number 14, Elvis Presley, Surrender. At number 13, The Everly Brothers, Walk Right Back. At number 12, The Beatles, From Me to You. At number 11, Ray Charles, I Can't Stop Loving You. At number 10, Telstar, The Tornadoes. At number 9, Elvis Presley, Marie's the Name, His Latest Flame. At number 8, The Shadows, Wonderful Land. At number 7, Jerry and the Pacemakers, How Do You Do It? At number 6, Kathy's Clown, The Everly Brothers. At number 5, Only the Lonely, Roy Orbison. At number 4, Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, Shaking All Over. At number 3, Danny Williams, Moon River. At number 2, Apache, The Shadows. And at number 1, Del Shannon, Runaway.
Righto.
Hmm.
But well,
this is what happens when you try and put objective scores onto subjective categories a little bit. You know, a lot of these are getting better. They're better production, and that's going to tip.
Gary, it's fine.
No, I'm interested as
much. Normally, I tell you off, and I make a sighing noise and all that sort of stuff.
That's
but now I just want you to believe in yourself.
I think that's what it is. You haven't sighed at me for so long. I'm starting to sigh at myself. No, it's interesting because it's I kind of feel like I do believe myself. I kind of feel like that's not too far off. There's the instrumentals are getting an unfair kind of advantage because of being averaged over two scores. But you know, if you took them out, I think it still is a good bunch of songs.
Yes,
a lot to do, a lot to go.
Yeah,
and yes, and that's that for this week.
Brill.
So. We'll see you next week.
Yeah, we will. You just sound stunned, shocked and stunned.
I've forgotten how to end the podcast. I'll just say bye then.
And I'll say, the Beatles are here! Beatles, good Beatle.